everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 290. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, join the 5,000 folks who are hanging out with us on Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Thank you guys so much for all of the incredible emails about last week's show with Paige Davis. But we got another great show for you this week. Let's start with our guest. While most teenagers in high school are figuring out who they are and where they want to go, this week's guest, Alec Fisher, was drawing from his past experiences to create a documentary about bullying and teen suicide. The film has since earned numerous awards and has been shown in schools internationally and continues to be featured in education conferences and festivals across the country. Alec himself has spoken across the Midwest to students about bullying, prevention, suicide awareness, and the power that youth empowerment, one of my favorite phrases out there, holds for creating positive social change. Additionally, Alec is the co-founder of Can't Convert Love Minnesota, which has worked to end conversion therapy there in the North Star State. And he's got his own videography company, and he's written for the Huffington Post, and he's reaped in humanitarian and innovation awards, and somewhere in there, I assume and hope that he goes to class, which we will check in about. But first, Alec, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Do you go to class?
That is the question. I do. I do, in fact, go to class.
Let's tell everybody where you're at right now, because I get nervous that what if your family listens to this and they learn through this podcast, no, our family member, he doesn't go to class anymore.
I do. I attend the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus.
Very exciting. And are we on break right now? Are we ready to go back?
Yes, we don't start for another half month or so. So okay. I have quite a long break ahead of me.
All right. Well, we have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I think so.
All right. We'll find out. Let's find out. So let's start with your high school experience. As I said, you know, everybody else is just kind of flitting about and figuring out who they are. You realized in high school, am I wrong, that you had this passion for movies and for creating documentaries.
Yeah, that's correct. In middle school, I started doing short horror films. And, you know, as good as I could make those at the time, that was my drive, my hobby on the side.
Nice.
And then when I got to high school, I realized that you could take the medium of film and really have an emotional connection with the audience and really, share stories in a powerful way. And I got really into, you know, nonfiction and documentary work specifically.
How did you come to focus on bullying as the theme for your documentary?
Yeah, I'd been bullied in middle school, and had a lot of friends who have been bullied in middle school as well for a number of different reasons, sexual orientation, race, religion, parents' income, all across the board. And when I got to high school, there wasn't really anyone who was talking about it in a real way.
Right.
There weren't very many student-to-student interactions about it. It was just groups coming in, talking about it, and then leaving. You know, people would be kinder to one another for the first couple of days after, and then after a week it'd go back to normal, and
yeah,
People would just, you know, forget that that even happened. And so I was curious about, you know, my story had had such an impact on me and my friends in my life that I was, you know, interested in hearing other students' stories as well. So my senior year of high school, I traveled across the state of Minnesota and filmed a number of people, talking about their stories being bullied. I actually started by interviewing teachers, adults, students, you know, people who in any way were connected to bullying in, you know, in schools. And then I looked at all the footage and realized that it was going to be way more impactful if I only had students.
That's
kind of how it happened. And it was a year-long process, so very lengthy, but it taught me a lot, and it was really interesting.
Well, I actually want to go right there to what it did teach you. I would imagine that had quite the effect on you every time you filmed one of those stories.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very new experience for me. I had done some videos for the high school administration, but other than that, you know, I hadn't really sat down and interviewed people on such a deep level, which really taught me how to be professional in a very deep setting at times. There were, you know, certain stories where I had to fight back tears listening, and, you know, you have to maintain that composure as the person filming and as the person in charge of that, while at the same time trying to connect with the person you're interviewing and letting them know that they are in a safe space and, you know, they really can open up, which I think was something that surprised me about, you know, how willing and how amazingly open these people that I interviewed were, because it's not very easy sharing your story, and some of these stories are, you know, very dark and very personal.
Yeah. Well, you've screened it all over the place. Tell me about one of those screenings that just it made you think, holy cow, look at what I did.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that stands out to me is I presented it at a high school. It was one of the first high schools. I presented it at my high school first, and after I showed it two times to about 500 to 600 people each showing, and everyone was like, you have to keep showing this at other schools. You know, you can't just stop here. And I think that showing stuck out to me because, you know, it's at my high school, and I had always been a very smiley person. People, you know, really resonated with me, and, you know, people were coming up after seeing it and were like, I had no idea you were bullied that badly. Like, I had no idea that was something that was a part of your past. You know, I would have never recognized that just talking to you. And some of these people had known me for a number of years and were shocked. And there was actually someone who had been one of the biggest instigators for me throughout my life, one of the biggest bullies for my own personal journey. And he came up after the showing and was like, you know, I didn't know bullying was a problem. That's so cool that you're doing this. You know, thanks for making this film. And that took me, you know, that was a moment of impact for me because, you know, this kid who had bullied me for so many years didn't realize that he had been doing that. You know, I mean, there was no recognition to him. It was just, you know, getting a laugh out of his friends, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't memorable. And, you know, I'll remember the stuff he did to me for the rest of my life. And, you know, he came up after and was like, that's so cool. Like, I'm so glad you did that.
Wow.
Had no recognition that, you know, he was one of the people that motivated me to do it. So
I have to ask the follow-up question. What did you say to him? My mouth is a little bit agog at that just because, quite frankly, we've talked about bullying so much over the past 7 years of doing the show. And I don't know that that's ever really come up. Often we have guests, and even myself have said, I would love to go back and talk to that one guy, you know, one of those prime instigators, and it would not even occur to me, Alec, that he would say, oh my gosh, I didn't even know, you know, that this was that big of an issue kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of things rushing through my head. When
I bet.
a lot of possible things I could have said, but I ended up saying, you know, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was something along the lines of, you know, well, you just have to keep your eyes open and recognize what's going on around you. And, you know, thank you for your feedback. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I didn't have the courage at the time to be like, you know, you were the inspiration for part of this. But
I think you're a good man, Alec Fisher. I think you're a good man, better than maybe most of us.
Maybe. We'll see.
Oh, man. All right. So you toured that all around. Were you surprised by the response that the film got?
I was very surprised.
Yeah.
You know, the first showing at my high school, you know, you gather students together in a space and they're going to be rowdy. There's going to be phones out. There's going to be talking and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I remember the first showing started at, I think it was like 9 or 10 a.m. in the morning, and you could have heard a pin drop.
Wow.
I mean, it was dead silent the whole film. And it was a 45-minute film at the time. I shortened it a little bit in the last year or so, but, you know, at the time, for 45 minutes to have, you know, 500 students sitting there dead quiet, no phones out, nothing, the whole time, it was remarkable. I mean, there were two showings, so the one after that, they had to turn people away because the theater was so packed.
Wow.
Because people were like, you know, if you haven't seen this, you have to go see it. And there were students who skipped their second class that day to come see it again, which I was not at all expecting that. I mean, that was just
amazing.
It was incredible. Yeah.
Wow. All right. So that's the bullying film. And the hope is, of course, right, I don't know Minnesota as well as I know some of my other states, so I don't know the status of anti-bullying laws there. But my assumption, as with most states, is that they can only get better. So I would assume there's some work to do there.
Yeah, it's really exciting because we actually had this past year, you know, after the film came out, there was a big, I mean, it wasn't because of the film, but the film came out at a nice time where there was being a real big push for, you know, bullying prevention legislation to be enacted in Minnesota specifically. And so I was part of that large push and testified at the state capitol and worked for a number of years after the film came out to, you know, tell legislators that they should pass this law. Minnesota actually had one of the shortest and weakest bullying prevention laws in the entire country. And this past year, that law, or that bill, passed and became law.
Amazing.
So now Minnesota has one of the most comprehensive and thorough, hopefully strongest, bullying prevention laws in the country. So this year we're seeing how it's playing out, and we shall see in the next, hopefully, couple of years if it makes any huge changes.
Makes you want to make a new film called Minnesota Nice with an exclamation point.
Exactly, the follow-up, the sequel.
Get rid of that question mark. Okay, so there's bullying, and closely connected, but still a different issue, which, you know, there's not as many people talking about as there should be, is the issue of conversion therapy. I think we actually covered this last week, because Washington, D.C. just became, you know, if we count Washington, D.C. as one of the 51 states, which those in Washington often do, one of only three states to have a ban in conversion therapy. They're with California and New Jersey. Talk to me about why focus your energy on conversion therapy.
Yeah, definitely. It started, my friend Gabe and I, last year, we both attended the U. We were both political science students at the time, and had been doing some research on some, you know, LGBTQ activism work in the country, and happened upon this group called Can't Convert Love, that was started by students, and its goal was to ban conversion therapy on a national level. And so we reached out to them and were like, hey, you know, can we start a chapter of this in Minnesota? And they were like, absolutely. So we founded Can't Convert Love Minnesota, and that was last October, so October of 2013.
Okay.
And we ended up in the next month writing legislation based on the bills that had passed in California and New Jersey, and we worked with a couple legislators and got those all set up and got some co-authors and some sponsors and tried to have it be passed. And so, you know, for the past year or so, it was killed in session, unfortunately. So this year we've rallied our troops and are trying to come back stronger to get it past this upcoming session.
You wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called "This Is What Happened When I Tried Banning Conversion Therapy in Minnesota." And in that piece, let me read a little bit from that. You wrote, quote, "It was during this time that I realized how much of a game politics really is, having to compete for time and attention against bills that were being pushed by groups with deep pockets, pools of volunteers, and paid lobbyists created hurdles for me and Gabe to tackle with limited resources. The influence of this political power structure became apparent to us once we realized how difficult it is to reach the top of the legislative priority list. These setbacks left me angry and disappointed." How are you feeling these days about it? You know, look, I've been a part of the political process. Not all of us have these deep pockets and pools of volunteers and paid lobbyists. Some of us, you know, just have Gabe, like you just had Gabe and all the other folks who were supporting you. We all need a Gabe, by the way, right?
We do, definitely.
Yeah.
Gabe is a necessity to everyday life.
All right. He'll love that. He'll love that.
I know, he'll be like, ah, I'm a shout out.
It's a resume builder, Gabe. Run with it. But it is angering and disappointing and frustrating. How do you work through that?
Definitely. I mean, it was frustrating to the point where I actually changed my major. I switched from political science to communication studies. So the frustration was extremely real. You know, I think the main thing was recognizing why I was feeling that frustration and that anger and making sure it didn't channel into negative outlets. What I ended up doing is Gabe ended up taking over the legislative side of things, you know, working with politicians and all of that. And I shifted my direction towards communication and outreach. And so what we ended up doing as co-founders is Gabe took on that legislative side, and then I've been doing a lot of social media and reaching out to build a coalition of groups and volunteers and that stuff. So we've tried balancing it. So I work with the politicians the least amount of time possible, and Gabe takes on that, which I'm really lucky and thankful for him for, because he really knows what he's doing.
Nice.
So that's kind of the remedy to the solution, is I focus more on outreach now.
Yeah, it's just, it's so frustrating when you just think, okay, we're talking about something that is so unbelievably proven and researched to not only never convert any youth, but in fact, it does so much more harm than good, especially because it does no good. And why can't everyone just get on board with that?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the most important thing is, you know, this bill that we're writing, it's specifically protecting minors. You know, we're not trying to limit anyone's, you know, freedom once they're 18 to sign themselves up for this type of therapy if they really want it. You know, it's just about most of these, you know, under 18-year-olds are forced to go to these sort of places by their parents or guardians. And you know, the psychological effects of that are very traumatic. And so, you know, I think that's been the hardest part, is trying to convey that this isn't something we're trying to ban, you know, for adults who have that freedom to do that. I mean, eventually that would hopefully be a point where that's no longer accepted as a therapy. But, you know, we're trying to protect the youth in the state. And I think, you know, it's hard to argue that you don't want children to be safe, but somehow people find a way to do it.
Isn't it amazing?
Yep.
That yep. is amazing. All right, so you have that going on. I don't even understand what a Dalai Lama fellow is. I feel like if I went around and told people that I was one, they would laugh at me. But that's more about me than it is about you. What does that even mean?
Yeah, well, there's a program called the Dalai Lama Fellows. It's a fellowship program. And it focuses on helping social change makers around the world carry out social change projects. And so every year they select about 12 fellows from across the world and give them funding for a social change project. And I was one of the recipients of the last year's fellowship. And so I've been working on a social change project on top of Can't Convert Love and the documentary I've been doing, working on a platform that would connect social change makers online who are in college looking for ways to get involved. And so that's the Dalai Lama Fellows and how I'm involved in it. And it's a beautifully done program. And it's, you know, I've met some of the most inspiring people, you know, that I would have never imagined meeting 2 years ago. And it's been fantastic.
I would like to again say, not only as a college professor, but someone who cares about you, Alec, I'm worried that you're not going to class. Doing so much.
I somehow managed to get that snuck
right.
in there. So.
All right. He was on Dean's List, folks, so it's real. It's real.
I do go to class. So.
And does the work, too, which is, let me tell you, from my experience, you got to do both of those things. Very important. Very important.
Exactly.
Now, sir, you went personal. You went pretty personal just a few weeks back with another Huffington Post piece. Let me read the title. Let me just do the title. 5 Healing Strategies I Discovered After My Boyfriend Tried Cheating on Me. First, what made you want to go personal with this and put this out there?
I think, you know, I describe it a little bit in the article, but I think the main thing is that I'm a very input-oriented person.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my healing process has really been reading as many articles about how to heal and how to discover, you know, inner peace with yourself after something like this happens. And I think it was really important for me to write what I was feeling and put it all into one cohesive list. And I also read a lot of articles that were very focused on marriage cheating, you know, cheating within a marriage or a partnership that was more concrete than just, you know, boyfriend and boyfriend or boyfriend and girlfriend. And that was difficult because, you know, as a college student, obviously there are different
right.
priorities with healing that you're looking for than someone who's been married for 15 years, you know, and that process looks very different. And so I think it was really important for me to not only write about it, but also share it because, you know, looking for that kind of information was very hard for me. And I know a lot of my friends have gone through similar things. I actually discovered a lot of them had gone through similar things once I started talking about it and once I published the article. And so I think it was just very important to get out a way for college students to relate. You know, if they're going through something like that, they can read it and hopefully take a few of the strategies and apply them to their own lives.
Yeah. The impact of these apps, it's almost indescribable, which doesn't make for good radio, but it's really, I don't think that anyone can really wrap their mind around how interwoven sometimes some of these social media apps are with the way that we go about forming relationships with other people, and more specifically in your scenario, going through a process of healing.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that, you know, it's very interesting, the power of social media. You know, it has so many ups and downs, and I think, you know, in a situation like this, I can get frustrated because, you know, my ex was using social media as a tool to, you know, try cheating on me. But at the same time, I've been able to connect with so many people over social media afterwards who have needed support or who were, you know, wanted to talk about it. And, you know, just looking at that is, I think, incredible. Sometimes mind-blowing for me, you know, to think about how different that is, but also how much power it holds.
Yeah. Amazing. Again, the piece is 5 Healing Strategies I Discovered After My Boyfriend Tried Cheating on Me. We will link to that as well. We got to talk about youth involvement because that is – it's one of those things that I want to focus on all the time. Obviously, my day job, that's what I'm trying to do, is try to get college students involved more in social justice issues and to use their voice. But the response I get 9 times out of 10 from my students are that they don't feel that their voices are valued and they don't feel that they have the ability to create change. You seem to be hearing a different message. So how can we get what you do out there more? Let's do some empowerment right now.
I think, you know, I went around and spoke in schools, mainly middle school and high school. And something I always focus on there is if you want to talk about something, talk about it. If you have something to say, say it. And, you know, there's going to be pushback depending on what it is. And if it's something that's related to social justice or social change and you feel that there's a change that's needed, you know, even if you're the only voice speaking out, there are probably other people who have the same thoughts in their head who just are maybe not empowered enough to say it themselves. And so, you know, not being afraid to start having those conversations, even if you're uncomfortable with them, you know, admitting that you're uncomfortable when having them. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily know how to go about saying certain things that they want to say or talking about certain things that they want to talk about.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I would just say, don't be afraid of messing up and admitting that you are new, you know, to speaking about that sort of thing and, you know, will make mistakes. I think that's the number one thing is, you know, you're not going to be perfect talking about something. It's going to be uncomfortable. But, you know, I'm a firm believer that change only happens when you're out of your comfort zone. So, you know, you'd hope that at some point having conversations that are difficult, it would be uncomfortable because that means something is hopefully going to change.
Yeah. And it's working through, as you said, working through those setbacks. You, sir, have had some setbacks and you still keep going.
Definitely. I mean, if I have a project with no setbacks, that's a little odd.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I must have missed something that I messed up at some point because this is flawless and that shouldn't be happening. So, yeah, usually for everything, there's a number of setbacks and in a way that makes the projects I do a lot more meaningful and it adds a lot of growth to them as well.
Okay. All right. This is all good stuff. This is all good stuff. What can our listeners do to support your efforts, in particular with conversion therapy, banning it?
Yeah, definitely. We do have a Facebook page. Gonna do a selfless plug right there.
Do it. No. That's what this, we do plugs here. This is what we do, Alec.
All right. Well, Can't Convert Love Minnesota. It's just Can't Convert Love and then MN. Should pop up on Facebook. We've got about, I think it's 1,150 likes right now, somewhere around that number. So hopefully that'll grow. And you can send us a message through that if you want to get involved or have questions, anything like that. You can definitely reach out through that.
Again, it is only California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. that have those laws on the books saying, hey, we don't want to harm our youth. We don't want to harm our minors. So that leaves a pretty large chunk of the country with a ton of work left to do. But it does require that people step up and use their voice. Otherwise, nothing changes.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
How about your own Twitter handle? Do we want to throw that out there so people can, you know, always find out what Jesse J song you're listening to?
Yeah, that's a great idea. It's just Alec Fisher. It's at AlecFisCHR. A little tricky, skips the ER, just goes to the R. But yeah, that's my Twitter handle. And then on Facebook, Alec Fisher Films, AlecFisCHER, and then Films. If you look that up, that's my professional page for my videography work.
Nice, nice. Well, look, there is nothing that makes me happier. We've done, episode 290. We've only had a handful of folks on. Quite frankly, I feel like we've only had a handful of folks on under 30, much less under 25, you know, and this is important. It is important that people use their voices and not be deterred by the setbacks and not be completely pushed down by the voices saying, no, you have to be this age or have this credential. It's just about people using their own voice to say, look, this is what I believe in and I want to create change. And my friend, you are a pretty incredible example of that and one who goes to class as well and that even better. Even better.
Thank you. I appreciate those kind words.
All right. You're going to keep us posted on what you are doing, and we would love to have you back and learn even more.
Yeah, definitely. I'll definitely keep you posted.
I stay out late because I don't want to feel lonely. This emptiness, it's starting to warm me in. I can't get out. I can't get out. I'll meet you later, yeah, I'm not done. She's trying hard, you're trying not to fight her hand. I can't get out, I can't get out.
oodles and oodles of time left on this week's episode, and there is so much news out there, so let's get to it. I am going to fly solo this week, because Becca, our poor Becca, is pretty flu-laden. She's been hit down pretty hard by the flu, so our wish is for her to get better real, real soon, and also that I do not get the flu. I've already had it once this year. I would like to not have it again. By the way, do you guys get flu shots? Because I got one. I still got the flu. And of course, all the other professors on my floor, they didn't get flu shots. They didn't get the flu. I don't like it. I don't like it. Let's get to the gay news. We're going to do a couple different segments. We're starting with Florida. This whole segment is all about Florida because there is so much happening in Florida. So let's start at the beginning. The federal judge overseeing the challenge to Florida's marriage equality ban ruled last week that his current injunction applies only to the couples who sued to be able to marry, but noted that any other couples who are refused licenses beginning this week on January 6th could ask to be added to the case. The clarification order came about when the clerk of Washington County asked the U.S. court judge Robert Hinkle whether the current injunction requires licenses be issued to all same-sex couples who seek them or just the plaintiffs in the case. So obviously what they're saying is, okay, fine, so these few plaintiffs in the case, maybe they can get married, but the clerk is asking everyone else can't, right? That's correct, correct? Right? No. This is what the judge has said. Quote, no plaintiff now in this case has standing to seek a preliminary injunction requiring the clerk to issue other licenses. The preliminary injunction now in effect thus does not require the clerk to issue licenses to other applicants, but as set out in the order that announced the issuance of the preliminary injunction, the Constitution requires the clerk to issue such licenses. So that's a lot of jargon right there, right? So such a ruling would leave things very much in the air when the stay on Hinkle's injunction ends on January 5th, but the judge went on. He wrote this, quote, a clerk who chooses not to follow the ruling should take note. The governing statutes and rules of procedure allow individuals to intervene as plaintiffs in pending actions, allowing certification of plaintiff and defendant classes, allow issuance of successive preliminary injunctions, and allow successful plaintiffs to recover costs and attorney fees. End quote. It's a lot of jargon. I can't actually think of a time that I've said that much jargon on this show. Thankfully, this is what it actually means. In other words, if a clerk refuses to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples on January 6th, this judge has put them on notice that he is ready, willing, and able to order them to issue licenses. Pretty darn exciting. So, unsurprisingly, LGBT legal groups who argued to Hinkle that the ruling should apply statewide to all same-sex couples, they are declaring victory. Shannon Minter, who is the legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, said in a statement, quote, today's ruling confirms that all Florida County clerks must comply with the federal constitution by issuing marriage licenses to qualified same-sex couples beginning on January 6, 2015. So, there we go. Now, clerks in Florida, you've been told by this judge, he will intervene if you do not issue marriage licenses to everybody who applies. So obviously, listeners, that means that the clerks will comply and they will issue the marriage licenses to anyone who applies, right? No, that's not what's happening. The clerks have gone in a different direction. 14 Florida counties now, instead of having to issue licenses to anyone who applies, they have decided not to issue licenses at all so that they don't have to issue them to gay couples. To comply with the judge's ruling, clerks have said that they will issue marriage licenses, but in recent weeks and months, the majority of clerks in the conservative panhandle have chosen to stop performing courthouse weddings. Some said their offices were too cramped and they had too few employees to continue the tradition. Others blame shrinking budgets that forced them to shift resources. Holmes County Clerk of Court Kyle Hudson said this, quote, being a very small county, our staff numbers are very low and workload is quite high. Therefore, we will not be performing ceremonies for any couples, regardless of sexual preference. By the way, the fact that he said the word preference and not orientation is pretty indicative of his grasp of what it is to be gay, just putting that out there. Nearly all of them have changed their policies since August when U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle of Tallahassee, our buddy we've been talking about for the past few minutes, when he ruled that the state's gay marriage ban was unconstitutional. Several clerks, including Okaloosa County's J.D. Peacock II, have acknowledged that Hinkle's decision played a major role in their decisions. Peacock said this, quote, "I do not want to have members of our team put in a situation which presents a conflict between their personal religious beliefs and the implementation of a contentious societal philosophy change." The counties that no longer offer courthouse weddings include Bay County, Santa Rosa County, Okaloosa, Holmes, Washington, Jackson, Calhoun, Liberty, Franklin, Wakulla, Baker, Clay, Duval, and Pasco. It's really quite unbelievable. So this would be the classic kids in the sandbox saying, wait a second, if everyone can get married, then we're saying no one can get married. And so they are taking their toys and they are going home. They don't want everyone to play ball anymore, so they're going to take the ball and go home. It really is quite unbelievable. Let's go back to that one clerk Peacock statement. I do not want to have members of our team put in a situation which presents a conflict between their personal religious beliefs and the implementation of a contentious societal philosophy change. Well, sir, that's actually part of working in a government office. You don't have the liberty of just deciding this is what I want to get involved in, this is what I don't. Now, I do not believe, let's pause right here, I do not believe that anyone should be in a situation where they are forced to go against something that they believe in, unless you've opted into that. And if you are choosing to work for the government, you are opting into that. And so thus, if these clerks do not believe in their heart of hearts that people should get married based on their, I'll use their words, sexual preference, I am all for them not having to perform those marriages. But to me, the next sentence is, they should quit. They have made a decision to work for the government. They have made the decision to be a civil servant in that way. They can come work for a private institution. That's totally fine. It's really difficult for my university to force me, now we're talking about within the bounds of the law, to force me to do anything that I don't want to do. But that's also because I have made a choice to work for a private organization. These folks have made a different choice. They don't want to perform same-sex marriages. I am all for them saying, no, we're not doing it. But the next sentence is not, we're just not doing it and remaining in our jobs. The next sentence is, we're not doing it, and thus we have to make the decision to quit. Not what they're doing. Now, Attorney General there in Florida, Pam Bondi, has issued a statement saying that her office will not, quote, stand in the way as clerks of court determine how to proceed. So this is what she has said, quote, this office has sought to minimize confusion and uncertainty, and we are glad the court has provided additional guidance. My office will not stand in the way as clerks of court determine how to proceed. So now the question is whether Bondi is going to step in and appoint new clerks to say, hey, you got to follow what this judge has told you to do. But they are just not going to issue marriage licenses at all. So that is the solution they have come up with. You guys all want to get married? Well, then no one could get married. Now, my question is for the straight couples, for our heterosexual couples who now thought and planned on going to the courthouse and getting a marriage license, I am telling you, if this does not now suddenly make you an ally of same-sex couples being able to obtain a marriage license, I do not know what will. So in some ways, this is the argument that people who have been arguing against granting marriage licenses to same-sex couples have been arguing all along, albeit in kind of a reverse way. And the argument all along was, well, if they get married, this is going to affect my marriage. Yes, but not in the way that you think. Now that these same-sex couples are allowed to get married, the county clerks are saying no one can get married. So yes, it is affecting your ability to get married. But I would hope that this is the opposite outcome. Instead of making you against the issuance of marriage licenses for same-sex couples, I would hope you would now be for it. Because you now cannot get married, not because of the same-sex couples, but because the clerks there in Florida have decided no one can get married. If this is not a recipe for creating allies, I have absolutely no idea what is. I would certainly, which I'm not, either in a relationship nor heterosexual, I would certainly be sitting there and saying, wait a second. So we can't get married because those people can get married? And now no one can get married? This is ridiculous. So my hope, again, recipe, just add water and some Florida county clerks. This is the recipe for creating more allies in Florida. But wait, there's more. So much more happening in Florida. It's a whole Florida segment. Senator Marco Rubio is sharply criticizing court rulings paving the way for same-sex marriage in his home state of Florida. In a brief interview this week, the potential presidential candidate, we're not sure yet if he's running, but he argued that a federal court's move undermines the will of the 62% of Florida voters who approved a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage 6 years ago. He argued that supporters of same-sex marriage should have taken the issue to the ballot box or through the legislature instead. He said this, quote, "If they wanted to change that law, they should have gone to the legislature or back to the Constitution and tried to change it. I don't agree we should be trying to make those changes through the courts." So many different comments on this one. First of all, yes, 62% of Florida voters approved that constitutional amendment. It is a key piece. It doesn't sound like it, but it is a key piece that was 6 years ago. 6 years ago, in the framework of marriage equality, is an incredibly long time. That's an incredibly long time. 6 years ago, the majority of the country was not for same-sex marriage. They weren't. Now, the majority of the country is. That is a monumental shift. So that's a big deal. So let's not minimize it. That was 6 years ago. But let's put that aside for a second. This is a guy who very likely will be running for president. And thus, as a civil servant in that way, no one has forced him into that. He is opting into that, just like those county clerks. He is opting into the entirety of the Constitution. He is opting into being a living monument to everything this country stands for as written in the Constitution. Okay, so can we agree on that? We're good there. Part of that is people being able to use the legal system. So the legal system, I have said this before, I'm going right back over it. People don't go to courts and say, hey, I want to get married. Can you allow me to get married? People use the court system to say, hey, there are laws on the books that are discriminating against me. Can you, court system, as people who have been trained in this and appointed to this and in many cases elected to this, can you please interpret the laws to see if this law as written discriminates against me? Because that is one of the three branches of government. That's the whole purpose of the judicial branch, is for them to look at our laws and say, hey, okay, this was written, and I'm sure it was in good faith in some ways, but no, this is not constitutional. And so for Marco Rubio, who quite likely will be running for president, to say this branch of the government should not be used, this is what it's used for. These are people who have gone to the courts at considerable expense, both financially and with regard to their neighbors, because there's a lot of stigma about being those people who bring up this case. They have said, we're going to use the judicial system. And Marco Rubio says, no, that branch of government, you shouldn't be using that. I know it's always indirect, but I'm always confused about that whole phrase, activist judges, or where did these judges come from? The judges were appointed. It's one step removed, but we absolutely elected them. We elected a president who appointed them. We elected our representatives and our governors who appointed them. In many cases, like New York, these judges are elected. So I don't understand where we're saying, where did these judges come from, and this isn't within their right, and who appointed them anyway? We did. We absolutely did. Some of them appointed by George Bush. Many of them appointed by Republicans. Their sole role is to look into the legality and the fairness and the consistency with the Constitution of our laws. So it's just so confusing to me when Republicans, and they are largely Republicans, decry these judges are out of line. This branch of government should not be used. I don't agree, this is his quote, I don't agree we should be trying to make those changes through the courts. We're not necessarily trying to make the changes through the courts. We're trying to look into the fairness of our laws. The changes come when the judges say, oh, yeah, no, that law, totally not fair. Absolutely not fair. And then the changes come. So that's how that works. Now, interestingly, Rubio's comments are a departure from a fellow Floridian and potential GOP rival, former Governor Jeb Bush, who issued a much more conciliatory statement earlier this week when he was asked about same-sex marriages moving forward in his state. He said this, quote, "We live in a democracy, and regardless of our disagreements, we have to respect the rule of law." There it is, Jeb Bush. He went on to say, "I hope that we can also show respect for the good people on all sides of the gay and lesbian marriage issue, including couples making lifetime commitments to each other who are seeking greater legal protections, and those of us who believe marriage is a sacrament and want to safeguard religious liberty." I'm okay with Jeb Bush's statement there. Very good, Jeb Bush. The differing assessments showcase the challenges within the GOP to reconcile the views of its staunch social conservative base with its growing public support for same-sex marriage. So Rubio then, to complete the Rubio portion of our show, Rubio said he hadn't seen Bush's statement, but he said this, quote, "While I believe that marriage should be between one man and one woman, while people want to change that law, and a lot of people apparently do, there is a way to do that. You go through the legislature or you go on the ballot, but I don't agree that the courts have the power to do this," end quote. Again, further showing that Rubio doesn't understand that that's not what people are doing. The courts are looking into pre-existing laws. People aren't going to the courts and asking them to create new laws. 6 years ago, Floridians passed an amendment. People then went to the courts, again at considerable expense, to say, hey, this amendment that passed 6 years ago, is this legal? And the courts, you know, using their wisdom, said, nope, totally not legal. And then change comes. Very confusing to me. Very confusing to me that Rubio wants to teach our kids that, hey, there's really only two branches of the government. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. And that concludes our Florida section of this week's show. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back with even more news.
I was walking alone, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky, flash, bam! You came by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, when out of that orange colored view, wham, bam, alakazam, I got a look at you. One look and I yelled, timber, watch out for flying glass, cause the ceiling fell in and the bottom fell out. I went into a spin and I thought of the shot. I've been hit. Love came and hit me in the eye. Flash, bam, alakazam, out of an orange colored sky. Well, one look and I yelled, timber, watch out for flying glass.
right, folks, and we are back. Well, we're done with Florida. We're done with marriage right now. Let's bounce around to some other areas of LGBT news. In Atlanta, the city's fire chief was relieved of his duties this week after he published controversial comments about homosexuality in a book. In the self-published book titled, Who Told You That You Were Naked? Interesting title. Kelvin Cochran referred to homosexuality as, quote, unclean, a sexual perversion, vulgar, and inappropriate. Cochran received a month-long suspension in November. At the time, Mayor Kasim Reed said, quote, I want to be clear that the material in Chief Cochran's book is not representative of my personal beliefs and is inconsistent with the administration's work to make Atlanta a more welcoming city for all citizens, regardless of their sexual orientation, gender, race, and religious beliefs. At a news conference this week, the mayor announced Cochran had been relieved of his position. He said this, quote, not one time during the course of preparing this book did Chief Cochran ever think that it was appropriate to have a conversation with me, despite the fact that I have made my opinion and this administration's opinion clear on the topic. Reed said that Cochran was given an opportunity to resign and refused. Bottom line, Reed said, quote, he was terminated. Still in uniform after the news conference, Cochran told reporters, quote, I'm not apologetic for writing the book. He said he will not hide his Christian faith. He said, quote, everything I wrote in the book is based on scriptures, not my opinion. And he said, quote, LGBT citizens deserve the right to express their belief regarding sexual orientation and deserve to be respected for their position without hate and discrimination, but Christians also have the right to express their beliefs as well. So, this is much like the clerks issue. Absolutely, former Fire Chief Cochran, you can do that. You can do that. But you also can't opt in to work for a city, which is what you're doing, that has non-discrimination statements that prevent you from saying these things. So you can espouse your Christian faith. Nobody is saying that you can't do that. But you can't do that and be a civil servant. You can't do that and say, effectively conveying to a huge part of the Atlanta community, I kind of don't even believe that you need saving. Now I'm taking that to a different degree, but in some ways that's what he's saying. If I'm sitting there in Atlanta and I'm gay, I'm certainly a little bit nervous about calling the fire department because this is what the fire chief is saying out there. If there's even a little bit of a pause, which there would be, why would you willingly call people to your home? I mean, there's an emergency, so you would hope that you would make that call because there's a fire. But even that little fraction of a pause and thinking, oh my gosh, there are people in this fire department who are against everything that I am, that fraction of a pause is really dangerous. So there's that. Stephen Borders, the president of Atlanta Professional Firefighters, is very much in support of this. He said, quote, we wanted the city to take a strong, decisive action, which they've done. And here it is. This is exactly what I was just saying. This is what Border said, quote, it was the fire chief. He is our judge and our jury and our executioner when it comes to discipline. He is the ultimate representative of the city when it comes to public safety. There it is. There it is. So the Faith and Freedom Coalition, which is a conservative group, they are asking members of the public to contact the mayor, demanding Cochran be reappointed. They are saying this, quote, in our country, we don't punish people for the potential to discriminate. We punish them for actually discriminating. To our knowledge, unless the mayor knows about it and hasn't said so, there's no allegation to speak of. So there you go. However, the mayor did not list discrimination as the cause for termination. He said Cochran violated the city's code of conduct in releasing the book. Here's the final statement on the matter from the mayor. This is about how we treat one another. And so those folks who are calling me and telling me I should retain him, I just want you to know one thing. His religious decisions are not the basis of the problem. His judgment is the basis of the problem. That is what's going on in Atlanta. Let's go international. Let's go a little bit international. Vietnam. I don't think we've ever talked about Vietnam, you know, ever on this show, so that's kind of exciting. Vietnam has now taken the lead in gay rights in Southeast Asia by abolishing a ban on same-sex marriage. The revised law, while not officially recognizing same-sex marriage, places the communist country at the forefront of countries in Asia becoming more accepting of gay people. The National Assembly's move is expected to attract more lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender travelers and boost Vietnam's $9 billion tourism industry. Jamie Gillen, a researcher of culture geography at National University of Singapore, said this quote, "This makes Vietnam a leader in Asia. Singapore just reaffirmed its ban on homosexual behaviors. Vietnam is trying to pitch itself as a tolerant and safe country." So Singapore you might want to avoid, but Vietnam getting rid of its ban. There we go. Vietnam's new marriage law, which went into effect this New Year's Day, abolished regulations that prohibit marriage between people of the same sex. Same-sex marriages can now take place, though the government does not recognize them or provide legal protections in cases of disputes. So there's still more to go there in Vietnam. The government abolished fines that were imposed on homosexual weddings in 2013. No other country in Southeast Asia has taken as big a step towards accepting same-sex marriage as Vietnam. Very, very exciting. On the other side of the spectrum, we have Egypt. Holy cow. It's still really bad in Egypt. This is from the New York Times. Even if they were acquitted on the ludicrous charge of debauchery, the 26 Egyptian men on trial in the government's latest crackdown on gays are likely to suffer a lifetime of public scorn. Over the past 2 years, there has been no shortage of travesties and injustices in Egypt's courtrooms. The country's ousted dictator, Hosni Mubarak, was sentenced to life in prison in 2012, lying on a stretcher placed within a cage, only to be acquitted 2 years later in a subsequent proceeding once his allies were in power again. The Egyptian government has persecuted gay men with varying degrees of intensity over the past 2 decades. The latest crackdown has driven the gay community underground like never before. It is not entirely clear why Egypt's military leaders have ordered or condoned the prosecutions of men accused of being gay. In a deeply conservative Muslim country, demonizing sexual minorities has served in the past as an effective way of deflecting attention away from actual problems the state has failed to fix. This article goes on to say Egypt's treatment of gays is part of a dismal human rights record that has only gotten worse in recent months. The Obama administration and American lawmakers have not done enough to denounce the abuses of an increasingly authoritarian Egyptian government, which is one of the largest recipients of America's military aid. So, not good there in Egypt. The 26 men on trial now may never be able to shed the stigma this prosecution has inflicted on them, their careers, and their families, but strong international condemnation may keep authorities in Egypt from victimizing more men. So this is a call in the op-ed section of the New York Times to step in and do something about the crackdown on being gay there in Egypt. That's from the editorial board in the New York Times. So, yeah, not good. Not good there in Egypt. And finally, we return our attention for the third week in a row to TLC. Last week, Paige Davis, so much fun. But what started it was Becca and I talking about that new show coming out on TLC called My Husband's Not Gay, and the controversy keeps on going. This show debuts next week on Sunday, and GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and others are already speaking out against the special and calling on TLC to cancel it before it airs. To remind you, My Husband's Not Gay will follow the lives of four Mormon men, three of whom are married to women who struggle with what they call same-sex attraction. They don't describe themselves as gay. Not surprisingly, the subject matter isn't sitting well with GLAAD, which is our LGBT advocacy organization looking at the media. In a statement released on Tuesday, GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis, we love Sarah Kate Ellis, her partner has been on the show a ton of times, lead singer of Antigone Rising. Sarah Kate said this, quote, "This show is downright irresponsible. No one can change who they love, and more importantly, no one should have to. By investing in this dangerous programming, TLC is putting countless young LGBT people in harm's way." Josh Sanders, a self-described gay Christian man, has launched a petition on change.org calling on TLC to cancel the program. On that site, it says, quote, "Stop telling America that LGBT people should lie to themselves and to their faith communities about who they are and who they love." Sanders warned of the danger of those types of therapy that really damage people. We were talking about it earlier on the show with Alec Fisher. It's discredited processes that purport to make gay men straight. You can't pray away the gay. He went on to say, quote, "The men featured in the show deserve to be shown compassion and acceptance. Instead, TLC is presenting victims' lives as entertainment while sending the message that being gay is something that can and ought to be changed." Nearly 80,000 people have signed the petition online, many leaving comments adding their own personal stories and struggles with their gay identity and faith. I encourage you to go check that out. It's quite the petition. The petition can be found found. If you just go to change.org, it's called TLC, Cancel Your Upcoming TV Show, My Husband's Not Gay. And at last count, it is at, it's not at 80,000, I just clicked it to check. It's at 96,000. I'm sure by the time that you guys hear this episode, it will be at 100,000. What a horrible show. My Husband's Not Gay. Remember the day? Remember the day that it was Trading Spaces? And While You Were Out? We didn't even talk about While You Were Out with Paige Davis. I loved While You Were Out. But now, it's things like Breaking Amish. And it shows like Here Comes Honey Boo Boo and Long Island Medium and Sarah Palin's Alaska. No longer Trading Spaces. Very sad. I miss Trading Spaces and While You Were Out. Two great shows. Anyway, that's it. That's our news roundup. Our huge, huge thanks to Alec Fisher. I am so inspired. Look, I'm inspired by all our guests. I can't think of a guest. Okay, maybe I can think of one or two that I wasn't intensely inspired by. But, you know, by and large, every single guest we have on the show, I'm so crazy inspired by. And, of course, by someone who is in their early 20s, who is accomplishing everything that he needs to accomplish in college. He's going to class, folks. He's making Dean's List. But he's also realizing, you know what? I have a voice, and I'm going to use my voice to make a difference. You should be inspired by that. You should be using your voice to make a difference. That's what this show is all about. Go out there and do it. However it is that you do it. If you're starting an online petition, great. If you are petitioning your senators to do something, great. If you're telling your mayor, no, sir, we do not want you to reappoint the fire chief in our community. We stand by your decision. Whatever it is that you do to use your voice, go out and do it to raise up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Oh,